So I know some of you are still outside, but I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'm sorry I was neglecting this side of the room during the first talk, but there were a bunch of wires here, and every time I started to walk over here, I realized that they had been tripped. So we cleared them out, so I'll spend some time over here. So I talked about the sort of positive case for free enterprise, but what's changed in the last 10 years, when I first wrote Money, Greed, and God, it came out in 2009 in hardcover, I noticed creeping socialism on college campuses, and that's why I wanted to write about it. And my editor at the time, if you read the first chapter of the book, is about communism, and my editor actually wanted to take that chapter out because he was a Gen Xer like me. He said, Jay, this is beating a dead horse. Nobody's talking about communism and socialism. And I said, I know that's true. Nobody's talking about it by name, but the ideas are still there. Well, that's all changed, and there's a 10-year anniversary edition of the book coming out in June. And they said, why don't you say more about communism and socialism at the beginning, which I had in there at the beginning, and they had edited that out because they thought I went on too long. But a lot of this, I don't know if you have seen these polls, just the most recent poll, actually out just a couple of weeks ago, millennials, so people, Americans 35 and under, by a bare majority say they would like to live in a socialist country. All right, it's a majority that has never before happened in American history. And in fact, if you look at actual socialist candidates in American history, they rarely, at a national level, even in the 1920s and 1930s, got more than about 1% of the popular vote. The word socialism has never been popular. It drives European leftists crazy that Americans have never seemed to take to socialism like many Europeans did, but that things seem to be changing. And I think that part of the reason it changed is because the Soviet Union collapsed. The Marxists and socialists, they didn't disappear. They didn't all retire from higher education. They just sort of changed their arguments and learned ways to make them more appealing. They waited for a couple of economic downturns, the dot-com bubble and crash in 1999 and 2000, and then the financial crisis in 2008 became a pretense for them to make these arguments again. But what you'll notice in all of these polls, there have been about a half a dozen in the last couple of years, is that they never start by defining the word socialism. They just simply say, do you support it? Right? That's hugely significant. Now, no one's yet done it. If I had the money, I would commission this myself, where I would just read the dictionary definition of socialism and then ask the question. The problem, part of the problem with combating socialism is that nobody seems to know what it actually means. So here is the politician du jour, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, just the other day. So she defines herself, self-identifies as a democratic socialist. The only politician to do that before then was Bernie Sanders, who was a socialist from Vermont, right? And you just sort of treated him as, well, he's this one eccentric guy. Suddenly, this is a very popular thing. It's actually becoming very quickly kind of mainstream on the left in this country. But here's what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says at socialism. To me, what socialism means is to guarantee a basic level of dignity. Really? Like we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, right? Really? That's what you mean by socialism? This is absurd, right? So in other words, just basically a decent society where people are treated decently and with dignity, right? That's not what the word means. And so to make any progress on this, especially when you're talking with people, insist on getting clarity on what the word means. Now, Dick knows I'm going to be debating next Wednesday night at Notre Dame in South Bend. I am debating a leading socialist that's the editor of a magazine called Jacobin. So that's the name of the revolutionaries in the French Revolution, as a leading democratic socialist on the question of socialism. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to really dig into this. And I can tell you right now what he's going to do. He's not going to want to talk about actual socialism. He's going to want to talk about something different. And my argument is going to be, okay, when you're talking about an idea, right, you should be able to say, okay, what do the people who claim this idea, what have they actually done? Okay, who are the people that they actually draw on? That is, who are the thinkers that they depend on?
right? And then finally, what does the dictionary say about the meaning of the word? And it seems to me that if you're going to talk about socialism, the people that claimed they were socialists in the 20th century, that followed socialist thinkers who identified as socialists, and who conformed to the definition of socialism that's in the dictionary, that's socialism. All right, so what is it? Well, this is actually really easy. I just looked it up in Merriam-Webster. So here you go. This is Merriam-Webster's definition of socialism. Now, I assume this will soon be changed, but that's why I went in and put it on a slide. But here's what it was a couple of days ago anyway, all right? So definition one, any of various economic and political theories advocating collective or government ownership and administration of the means of production and distribution of goods. So the government owns and distributes the goods and the things that allow you to produce goods, right? Hold that in your mind. So there's a lot of other kinds of ideas floating around out there that aren't that. 2A, a system or society or group living in which there is no private property, all right? 2B, a system or condition of society in which the means of production are owned and controlled by the state. All right, and then finally, more complicated, but I'm going to talk about this in a minute. 3, a stage of society in Marxist theory transitional between capitalism and communism and distinguished by unequal distribution of goods and pay according to work done. All right, now did you know, people usually also, even if you kind of vaguely knew that's what socialism was, don't know what communism is and how these things are going to relate. So I hope to explain these things to you in the next few minutes. That's the definition. And so I am absolutely certain that if you ask 20-somethings with their iPhones, right, and Snapchat, do you think that the government should tell you where to live, where to work, how much you're going to get paid, who you're going to work for, and how much everything's going to cost? Does that sound like a good idea to you? Even the lefties would say, that doesn't sound great to me, right? Now, if they imagine themselves in charge of the process, maybe. Right, that's always the problem, is you assume, well, my friends and I, will we be making all the decisions, you know? But so you say, no, and you don't get to be in charge. Does this sound like a good system? I suspect these polls would be different. So I honestly think half of the game, half of the argument is just getting clear what the heck we're talking about. That's socialism as it actually is defined. But we have to deal with socialism as mental image. Socialism is mental image is, notice what Ocasio-Cortez wants. It's just a system in which people are accorded a certain basic level of dignity. She's giving you a picture and she's allowing you to fill it in. And if you ask people who say they like socialism, what they have in mind, it's, I'm telling you, almost universally, a Scandinavian village where everybody has a Volvo and just enough fish in the refrigerator and everybody kind of gets together and sings songs around the campfire. And it looks a lot like that. Right? That's the image that they have, right? And every kind of brotherhood of man, everybody's working together, getting along really well. Maybe a farmer's market for some reason. Anybody get to see pictures of the Soviet Union? You see those terrific farmer's markets in the Soviet Union, right? But that's the problem, is if you have a mental image of socialism, everybody likes that. That's awesome. Look at that. Now, I've been to Scandinavia, by the way, and most of it doesn't actually look like that, but there are some places in Norway that do actually look like that. All right? So getting the mental image out and the actual definition in, I think, is probably half the argument. The other part of the argument is just dealing with socialism as reality. Not just its definition, but what socialism actually did. The countries and the regimes that claimed to be socialist in the 20th century. Talking about socialism in 1910, people could be forgiven, perhaps, for not knowing, okay, what happens when the government just collectivizes all the farms and all the factories, just takes control of them and just starts setting production quotas and prices, right? Maybe you wouldn't know. You'd have a hard time guessing. But after it was tried in the early 1920s, Lenin tried this in the early 1920s, he actually had to introduce market reforms because millions of people starved to death. Because there was no price mechanism, and so people didn't know actually how to transport, and how much is a bushel of wheat supposed to cost? Nobody knew, nobody would sell, nobody would buy. The whole system broke down, and he had to introduce market reform. That was Lenin, as early as the 1920s. It didn't take but a couple of years to realize actual government control and ownership of everything leads to death and disaster. And it leads to death and disaster every single time it's tried. And so if somebody says, well, I have a different idea of socialism. Okay, so you're telling me we're supposed to ignore the dictionary definition, we're supposed to ignore the actual socialist experiments, and you're going to talk about some other thing. It's what? Your picture in your head. Right? That's tough sledding. That's a weak argument at that point, isn't it? It's like, okay, you want to talk about your fantasies. I want to talk about reality. But it's actually really hard to get to this point. Right? Because we'll talk about socialism as reality in a minute, but it is a grim and dismal picture involving mass death on a scale that had never before been achieved. But to kind of get what's going on in the background, you've got to understand Marxism. So I've defined socialism for you, but what is Marxism? Well, Marxism obviously is a particular ideology based upon the thought of the German philosopher Karl Marx. Now, Marx wrote a famous pamphlet with a guy named Friedrich Engels in 1848 called The Communist Manifesto. It's a great little book. You can read it in 45 minutes or an hour. And you got him over here? All right, good. So if you want to get the essence of capitalism, he tried to write his magnum opus was called Das Kapital, but he never actually finished it. And I tried to read it in college. It's impenetrable. And so read the Communist Manifesto to get his basic argument. Engels, by the way, was the guy that funded Marx. Marx was always a kind of penniless journalist who neglected his children, his wife and his children. And Engels' dad was wealthy and had factories, and so he actually funded Marx's career. But here's the basic argument in the Communist Manifesto. They don't give you this image, so I'm giving you this image so you sort of get the argument. They talked about the economic history as going through different stages. And so there was an original primitive communism. Think of it as a kind of like the Garden of Eden, in which there's no state and people lived in this preternatural freedom, did whatever they wanted to do, and there was plenty and everything was fine. But that for some reason fell apart, and then you ended up in an era of mass slavery, sort of state-based slavery like you had in the Egyptian Empire with the Jews, in which you had a king or a pharaoh, and you had massive numbers of slaves, and the slaves actually worked the fields. Same thing, the Roman Empire was based upon this system, and the Greek Empire was based upon this system. We sort of glorify the Athenians and the Spartans, but the Athenians and the Spartans were the citizens that lived in the cities. They didn't work the farms. The slaves worked the farms outside the cities. You never heard anything about them. So there's this kind of slave societies. And then the slave societies eventually gave way to feudalism in the Middle Ages. So people were not slaves anymore. There were lords that owned large amounts of land. And then they had serfs that worked the land. And they had a particular relationship. It's not totally free, but they sort of had obligations. And then the feudalist system gave rise to an industrial capitalism. Right? And under industrial capitalism, they said the concentration of wealth would be really intense. You'd get factories. People would become much, much more productive. But the amount of wealth would tend to concentrate in the hands of a few capitalists who owned the means of production. And then that system would, through its own internal contradictions, collapse. And it would be replaced by socialism. Right? And socialism was not the final stage. Socialism in Marxist theory is a transition stage between capitalism and communism. Communism is the ideal, not socialism for Marxists. All right? Now, what's the argument? Here's the basic argument. And so if you can see this, it's a little dark, unfortunately, but this is a pie chart, and it represents the different classes of society. So Marxist theory, it posits an eternal conflict between different classes of society, the king and the slaves, the lords and the serfs, the capitalists or bourgeoisie, and the workers, the proletariat. All right, and so in the capitalist system, what you have is these capitalists or bourgeoisie who own the means of production. They own the farms and the factories. And then they hire people and pay them a wage to work, say, in their factories, right? And they pay them as little as they can. And so what this represents, let's imagine this is England in 1700, and this represents the amount of wealth in the hands of different classes of people at that time. So it doesn't represent the numbers of people, it represents the amount of wealth in the hands of those classes. So the red represents the workers, right? And I don't know what that looks like, but it's a kind of light blue or lavender represents the amount of wealth in the hands of the capitalists. So it starts out, in other words, about 70% of the total wealth in the economy is in the hands of all these workers, maybe 99% of the population, and only about 20% is in the hands of the capitalist. But what Marx says is under capitalism, the capitalist will again have a, say, has a factory, hire a bunch of people, and let's say he's making shirts. And so they make shirts in the mills in his factory, and then he takes the shirts to the market and he tries to sell them for more than they cost to produce. And if he can do that, he makes a profit. But Marx called the profit a surplus value because he believed in something called the labor theory of value, in which something was worth exactly as much as it cost to produce it. So if you said, how much is this thing worth? You say, well, how much did it cost to produce it? And that tells you how much it's actually worth. So if the capitalist sells it on the market for more than that, then he has exploited the customer and the worker because he's gotten more than it was actually worth. All right, so remember that, it's gonna be crucial. But the capitalist doesn't go out and gamble away the profits at the local casino. Capitalist delays his gratification, he takes the profits and he goes back and he buys better equipment. He makes his factory more productive. And so now the workers can produce more with even less. So he can fire some of them because he doesn't need them all to work there. He can pay the rest even less, and they're still more productive because they have better equipment. He takes those shirts out into the market, and now he can sell them for even more because they cost him less, and he gets even more profit, right? And then he takes that profit back and he reinvests it, and he adds more equipment, and they become even more productive. And so this process of industrialization means that the workers get more and more productive, but the amount of wealth in the economy transfers inexorably from the hands of the workers to the hands and the coffers of the capitalist. All right, so here's the idea. You start out here in 1700, and you have a few cycles of this producing and reinvesting and profit making and reinvesting, and then the amount of wealth starts to shift, right? So notice the capitalists are that light blue, right? And as time goes on, you end up with fewer and fewer of the capitalists. And so they eventually end up kind of semi-monopolists. And so you can imagine this is getting to a point where 10 guys own almost everything, right? And just a little sliver is left for all the workers. Now that red, that's say 99% of the population just has that tiny sliver of the wealth. And a few people has the vast majority of the wealth. And then what do you think happens at this point? Revolution, right? Because the vast majority of people have almost nothing, and a few guys have almost all the wealth of the economy. So you have a violent revolution, the workers rise up, they confiscate the means of production, they liquidate the socialists, they liquidate the capitalists, and then you enter this new stage called socialism, in which the state owns everything on behalf of the people. So socialists won't describe it as state ownership, they'll say that everything is owned in common, though it turns out we know exactly what that means. So this is what it looks like. It's gray and it's uniform, right? It's homogenous. That's socialism. All right, that's the prediction of the Communist Manifesto. But that's not the end point. If you had asked a true believing Marxist in the Soviet Union in 1970, you looked around in Moscow and said, you know, this place is depressing. Have you seen West Germany? It's hopping. And look at this place. Everybody's poor. They're standing in line for food. They don't even have toilet paper. This is a disaster. They wouldn't have told you, well, yeah, socialism is wonderful. They'd say, no, we know that. Socialism is terrible. Socialism is a temporary stage in which the new socialist man will be created, in which people are no longer attached to things and possessions. But a new socialist man will emerge, and then at that point, the state will wither away. And suddenly we'll reach this utopia of communism, in which Marx describes this, which everyone has enough, right? Because of all the productivity of capitalism that's been distributed, then the state's unnecessary, withers away, and then people will be able to fish in the mornings and read in the afternoons and go hunting in the evenings. I mean, this is how Marx talked, right? Utopia. That's communism. So in other words, there's never been a communist society ever. Communism was the ideal of Marxist theory, but they always got stuck at the socialist stage. Now, why is that? Well, the simple reason is because Marxist theory is just completely wrong on the facts. All right, let me give you one example. Marx predicted in the Communist Manifesto that under capitalism, the wages of workers should go down. So as the factories got more productive, the wages of the workers in the factories should go down. He was writing this in London at the time, and there were factories 2 miles away where the wages of workers were going up and not down. Now, how's that possible? Now, think about it. Let's say you are work in construction, and you have access to a shovel. Or you work in construction, and you have access to a backhoe. Now, where is your labor worth more, with the shovel or the backhoe? Right? The capital, even if somebody else owns that tractor, you're going to fetch more if you know how to use a tractor and using a tractor because your labor's more productive. That's what was happening. And so workers, remember, because factories were competing for workers. And so as they got more productive and their equipment got better, the value of the labor of workers with that equipment went up, not down. So the basic economic facts of Marxist theory were just simply wrong. And they were known, could be known to be wrong at the time. The other thing I want you to notice is, remember that last myth we talked about, the materialist myth? Remember the pie? Notice what Marx's theory presupposes, right? Wealth isn't being produced here. It's just getting shuffled around. So the assumption is that if somebody has a heck of a lot of wealth, that has to mean that somebody else has way less wealth. It has to mean that. It only follows if that's how the economy is. It only follows if the amount of wealth in existence stays the same. But it doesn't. So Marx's theory is just simply wrong on the facts. And so what you ended up with, what was supposed to be thought of as a necessary evil to get to the communist utopia, ended up this dismal and horrific dystopia. Now notice that this was based, this is kind of a sidelight, but I want you to understand the theory really well. The key sort of plank in the Marxist argument is called the labor theory of value. The labor theory of value, it doesn't mean that, it's not the idea that labor can produce something of value. Obviously it can, right? But different kinds of labor produce different kinds of value. And labor by itself does not produce value. So think of two men doing exactly the same labor. One is digging a hole in the middle of a desert where nobody is, and he's working his fingers to the bone. That's the guy on the left. Another guy is in Santa Barbara, California, and he's digging a hole in a backyard for someone that wants a swimming pool put in, and he's working for a swimming pool contractor. Same amount of physical labor, right? Now, are they worth the same? Of course not. One's completely worthless. It's a terrible waste of time. One is actually really, really valuable. So what's different? The labor's not different. It's the context, right? It's what people actually need and want. One is oriented and channeled towards something of value to another person that they're willing to pay for. The other's just dumb labor. And so labor has to be constrained, has to be defined by particular ideas and oriented toward a particular purpose. And in fact, if you think about it, most of the wealth now, even in sectors in which there's a lot of physical activity going on, the value that's being created is being created because of the equipment, because of the technology, because of the context. Right? But Marxist theory, based on the labor theory of value, if you assume that theory is true, right, then you're going to end up with all these kinds of confusions of his theory. And so he couldn't understand how the capitalists could go and actually sell the shirts for more than they cost to produce. And the reason he did that is he figured out a way to make the shirts for less than people were willing to pay. Right? He was adding value to the system that didn't exist before. And so your understanding of what economic value is can end up completely confusing you or giving you a breakthrough and intellectual breakthroughs and understanding. This is what markets really do, right? They grow, right? They get bigger, right? They're not just kind of simply, but I know this is not the most amazing animation you've ever seen. This is the limits of my skill, I'm sorry. I wasn't gonna pay a designer. But you get the point, right? This is hugely important because it means under certain conditions and under certain economies, people can get fabulously wealthy, not by taking wealth from other people, but by participating in a process of wealth creation in which they create value for themselves and for others. Again, the late Steve Jobs, kind of a jerk, but he created a heck of a lot of wealth. Right? That's what markets actually do. And they couldn't be different than the socialist scenario. All right? So there's just really no reason whatsoever to believe the Marxist story. So do you understand? So socialism is essentially an economic system in which the government owns and controls all the productive property, right, in society. Marxism is just the theory of the Marxist theory of these particular economic stages, of which socialism is a temporary stage that follows from the capitalism that he misunderstood and leads ultimately to a communist utopia that never comes. That's Marxist theory. All right? And then capitalism is unfortunately this Marxist word that we got stuck with to describe the system that I'm defending, alas. Right? And so this is why the word's not great, but we're sort of stuck with it. But when I talk about capitalism, I'm not talking about the capitalism that Marx was talking about. Either you say, okay, he totally misunderstood it, right? It's actually something else and we use the same word, or we decide to use another word because it's just so messed up. All right? So let's talk a little bit about socialism in reality. Now this is super depressing, but let me give you a name of the main countries that tried to apply Marxist theory and implement socialism. So don't, when you hear this, don't think, oh, well, these are communist countries. Remember, none of them ever became communist. These were, all the things that happened in these countries were the result of socialist policies that they hoped would get them to communism. So the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, North Korea, Cambodia, which became Kampuchea, Vietnam, Laos, Burma, Albania, this is during the Cold War, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Poland, East Germany, Angola, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, Cuba, El Salvador, Venezuela. Now, does anyone want to live in these countries? No, nobody tries to get into these countries. They have to put walls up to keep people from leaving, right? That tells you what you ought to know. It's a book written in the 1990s by French intellectuals that were not at all conservatives, just tried to kind of tally up a conservative estimate for the death toll, not from wars, but just the death toll from these socialist experiments. And they estimated that it was at least 100 million people. In terms of just raw numbers, the Soviet Union and Maoist China get the top prizes, but in part because they were very big countries. But if you want to talk about just pure efficiency and proportion, that would be Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s. The Khmer Rouge they essentially emptied out the cities and moved everyone into the country, declared a year zero, renamed the country, put everyone in these kind of forced labor camps, and managed to kill about a fourth of the entire population in under 3 years. All right, so it's a small country, just a few million people, but can you imagine killing a fourth of the population? So that's the actual cost of these things. Now, I can tell you when people are talking about socialism these days, they don't want to talk about this. Nobody's talking about bringing back Stalinism or Maoism, right? What are they talking about? Democratic socialism. That's the buzzword, right? And that's the buzzword you're going to hear a lot about between now and 2020. So what is democratic socialism? Well, democratic socialism, in theory, is this attempt to get to socialism through the ballot box rather than violent revolution. So in other words, rather than having a violent revolution where the factories are confiscated, you just vote for politicians, and politicians implement laws and regulations in which the state slowly takes over more and more and more of the economy, either by direct ownership or by such complete control that it is effectively government ownership. Right, so that's different, right? There's not a violent revolution. You get there by the ballot box. So do you want to know the main example of this? Is that a train?
Yep.
Oh, okay. out of context, it kind of freaked me out for a second. Okay, good. It's on time. So you guys are used to it. I'm not used to it. I live in Washington, D.C., so I hear gunshots. I don't hear trains. That I'm used to, and it's right on time for Friday night. Venezuela is a democratic socialist state, right? It wasn't a violent revolution, right? Remember, Hugo Chavez was elected democratically, as was at least nominally his successor, right? Does that make any difference? Well, no, I guess maybe there wasn't a violent revolution. They're still starving to death. They're still completely out of toilet paper. They're still drinking sewage in Venezuela. I have Venezuelan friends that have managed to escape whose grandmother is still there, right? It is a complete disaster. And Venezuela was one of the most advanced countries in South America. It's in the northern part. It's very oil rich. If you went to, Caracas in Venezuela before this happened, they're speaking Spanish, but it wouldn't look that much different than it does here. right? They completely destroyed it in about 20 years of socialist policies. So there's nothing magical about democracy or voting bad policies in. The policies do what they're going to do, even if you can manage to get a majority of people to vote for them. Remember, Hitler was elected democratically too at the beginning, right? So putting the word democratic on the front of it shouldn't change the essence of the thing. Okay, so this won't be part of the kind of Marxist theory of revolutionary socialism, but it's still going to be socialism. And what's weird is, at least under Marxism, the Marxists and Marx himself knew socialism wasn't the end, wasn't the goal. They just thought it was a means to get to this communist utopia. Democratic socialists actually think this would be preferable to what we have now. They think it would be better, it would be more just, people would be better off. If anything, it's actually more delusional. These are just some recent pictures of the democratic socialist experiment of Venezuela. I mean, this is the current one, this is a food line. Right? It seems more benign, but socialist economic policies are going to have the same effect whether people vote for them or not. This is a picture from actually just last week. I mean, this is where it ends up, right? Because now all of a sudden the infrastructure for water purification goes offline. Caracas is mostly in brownouts and blackouts now. So think of a massive city of several million people suddenly without electricity. So you don't have sewage, you don't have electricity, you don't have refrigeration, right? It's a disaster. It is a human-caused catastrophe. So there's nothing magical about democratic socialism. But of course, again, except for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, no one's really saying let's do what Venezuela's doing either, are they? What do they talk about? They talk about Scandinavia, right? We're always hearing about what the Danes and the Swedes and the Norwegians are doing, right? And again, now, I happen to know a heck of a lot about Scandinavia, and I've been to this. This is called New Haven. It's a beautiful little canal in Copenhagen, and it's one little canal. It's just, this is the picture you always see of Copenhagen. There's a big city with a heck of a lot else going on. It's the only picture you see. So what about Scandinavia? Socialists always want to talk about Scandinavia. They say, I want the kind of democratic socialism that they have in Sweden or Norway. All right. Now, if you looked at Sweden in 1975, this would have been half right. Sweden tried something like soft socialism in the 70s, and they got up in 1975 to where government owned about half of all industry. All right. And you know what happened? It was a disaster. It was poor. It was depressing. People didn't seem to have any incentive to work. They're much rather, they're getting paid no matter what they did, getting paid the same amount. And they quickly reversed course. All the Scandinavian countries, first of all, they started out fairly prosperous before they tried their socialist experiments. They tried them, and every single one of them has been going in a different direction. And if you ask the president of Denmark, he will explicitly tell you, we are a capitalist society. We are a market economy. We are not a socialist economy. Now, what's different? They do have a large welfare state that comes with high personal income taxes. Now, that's a real thing. You can talk about that. That's different from talking about the government owning private property. And so if you actually look at Scandinavia, what's funny about it, it's just not socialist. In fact, if you look up the Index of Economic Freedom produced every year by the Heritage Foundation, or the Economic Freedom of the World Index, which is a similar index produced by the Fraser Institute, in Canada, just look it up. You can just Google this. Don't do it now, but Google it afterwards. Pull up the 2018 or 2019, I don't know if the 19 one has come out yet, Index of Economic Freedom, and look where all the Scandinavian countries are. They're all in the top 20 of 180 or so countries in the world. And in fact, Scandinavia, it's a really positive business climate. It's easier in most Scandinavian countries to start businesses. Denmark effectively doesn't have minimum wage laws. Their business regulations tend not to be onerous. They're in many ways actually more economically free than we are. The other thing to remember is that they're very different from us. Socialists often make this kind of mistake. It's a kind of a confusion of scale. And so they assume, society really works well in this family of five. Everybody's kind of sharing, and the dad and the mom sort of consult with each other, and then they tell the kids what to do, and everybody has enough to eat, and they get fed. And so let's just extrapolate that to a nation state that traverses an entire continent and do the same thing. That's what socialists do. They don't realize that actually the kind of interactions that work in one institution or at one scale don't necessarily work at different size scales. Denmark is about 5 million people. Sweden is about 8 million people. So Denmark, in other words, is about the size of Washington State. Until recently, it was very, very ethnically homogenous. It is a very particular culture, right? And if you take Danes and you put them anywhere else, they do really well in other places too. The point is you can't just simply extrapolate from what happens to work in this small, quirky country and say, oh, we can just do the same thing anywhere else. So that's the two main things to remember. One, they're not socialist. And two, why on earth think that we could just extrapolate from what happens to work in Norway or Denmark to a nation state with 330 million people, like the United States? There's no reason in the world to think that would make any sense. It's like Singapore, it's a city state, right? It's much more authoritarian. If you go there, you get in trouble if you throw gum on the sidewalks. I was there for a week with a co-author on a speaking tour and stayed with a man there who was from Singapore. And I said, how would you describe the political system in Singapore? He said, oh, Singapore has guided democracy. Guided democracy. It's such a euphemism. It's kind of creepy. I'm a Texan. You know, I was like, that sounds good. And then I went to Hong Kong for a week. I said, oh, thank you. You know, but it works. Because first of all, they're all kind of, they're in on it, right? Everybody sort of agreed to it. And it's a small place. And so that's why you can tolerate more social control in a family or a small voluntary organization than you're going to tolerate in a large nation state, right? And so there's all these kinds of intellectual confusions when you try to talk about socialism. What the socialists want to do is they want to use Scandinavia, which isn't socialist, as their example, and they want to ignore all the actual socialist experiments of the 20th century, right? So don't let them do that, because trust me, this is what they will all try to do if you're in a conversation with it. Now, what's the other reason that they talk about Scandinavia? I mean, why that? Because it's not like, if you look at the per capita income and different things, they're actually not a lot different than the United States, and in some measures, they're actually worse than us. So why do people always want to talk about Scandinavia? In the last few years, it's because of these studies that claim that they are the happiest countries, all right? Isn't this a great picture? I just love it for so many reasons. Vikings didn't wear horns on their helmets, though, for obvious reasons. You wouldn't want to have horns in, you know, a sword fight. That would be a stupid thing to have. Still, it's great. And in fact, in the last few years, the UN has started a happiness study in which they compare the countries of the world according to happiness. It's called their sustainability index, which by itself should tell you something's fishy. And every year, the United States manages to get lower and the Scandinavian countries get higher. And I think this year, it was Iceland. All right. Right. I mean, that, it's like it refutes itself. Really? Iceland is the happiest place? If you ask people in Iceland or in Denmark, they'll tell you, what are you talking about? We're not happier than other people. In fact, if you look at the actual statistics, it is true that Danes, when polled about whether they're happy, will say they are. But it's because in Danish culture, it's shameful to admit that you're unhappy. But if you look at the actual statistics, they have some of the highest rates of antidepressant use, of suicide, and of binge alcoholism. All the Scandinavian countries have these problems. So they will score the highest on both suicide rates and the UN happiness indexes, which should be enough to tell you there's something fishy about these indexes, right? And so don't trust them. Now, I'm not saying that all the happiness studies are useless. Within countries, they're useful. So I think you can actually use these happiness studies to say, okay, different segments of the American population, you can use them. But they're almost useless for comparing fairly similar countries, you know, similar economic status between countries, because the word happiness means different things. And you can end up with these countries that score the highest on the happiness index and on the depression index, right? And so if you'll notice, I'm just alerting you to this, because this is essentially, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but trust me, I know about this UN index. The purpose of this UN index is to get people thinking, all right, that a very large welfare state and some kind of soft socialism makes people happier, right? And so it's very dependent upon you thinking the Scandinavian countries are socialist and thinking that they're happier than the other places, all right? Not true. And this is deeply problematic. In fact, there have been several books, entire books, debunking this idea. But this is why you hear so much about it. All right, so I hope I've kind of thoroughly eviscerated the temptations towards socialism. But I want to give you just a few minutes here at the end on Christianity and socialism, because a lot of young kids, a lot of young folks actually think that, well, okay, you've given a bunch of economic arguments, but I mean, wasn't the early church communist? Right? I mean, if it's so bad, how is it that right after Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit fell upon believers when Peter was preaching, and 5,000 Jews from around the Roman world who were there for Pentecost immediately became Christians, one of the first things they did is the Holy Spirit told them to sell their possessions and share their possessions in common amongst their fellow believers. Isn't that communism? I get this question every time I do a radio interview on a Christian station about this subject in Acts 2, and you can read it. I'm basically summarized, but you all know that you know the text. All right, so is that communist? No. Okay, by any kind of stretch of the imagination, first of all, you know it's not the kind of communist utopia of Marxist theories. Let's talk about socialism. Okay, under socialism, the state owns all the private property. Where's the Roman state in Acts 2? Are the centurions breaking down doors and taking people's possessions? No. It's Christians spontaneously and freely and voluntarily selling their stuff. So that's the first thing. So this is not socialism. It's sharing. Sharing's not socialism, all right? So it's voluntary, it's small. Also, it's almost certainly temporary and peculiar to the circumstances. If you notice, if you read all of Paul's letters, he nowhere else, Paul never says to other churches in Thessalonica or in Corinth that they should orient themselves this way. So this is it was never held up as the model for how local churches ought to work. And that actually makes sense. Just think about the situation here. So remember what had happened. Again, this was Jews at the festival of Pentecost would come to Jerusalem, and several thousand suddenly became Christians. So all of a sudden you had these new believers. You had a few local new Christians that lived in Jerusalem or thereabouts, and then people that may have traveled tens or even hundreds of miles away. So they're away from their jobs, family, income, all those kinds of things. And then under that particular kind of emergency circumstance, some of the local believers were convicted by the Holy Spirit to sell their possessions because they had their stuff so that they could help out their new fellow believers so that new believers didn't have to leave immediately. But for all we know, this lasted for 6 months, and then those new believers went back to their places of origin. All right? So this was absolutely not communism or socialism. It was a temporary stage of sharing, and it holds true now. In certain emergency situations, this would be the right thing to do. But notice that even here, there was never any question but about the right to private property. You remember Ananias and Sapphira, or the husband and wife, who sell their stuff and claim to give it all to the church, but then they held some of it back. It's kind of a harrowing passage, because Peter shows up, and he tells them, you haven't just lied to me, you've lied to the Holy Spirit. And then they fall dead, right? So you think, okay, well, so that was bad that they had property. No, Peter says, wasn't the property still yours when you had it? They weren't punished because they had possessions. They were punished for lying to the Holy Spirit, right? In fact, Peter's statement only makes sense if there is a right to private property. So that absolutely is not what was happening in Acts. And if, in fact, the thing about the right to private property is there's no Bible verse that says you have a right to private property. It's sort of everywhere presupposed and assumed, but nowhere explicitly stated. But two of the Ten Commandments presuppose it. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. Right? That only makes sense if there's something you could rightly have that somebody ought not to take from you, or that they ought not want instead of you. That only makes sense if we, under some conditions, have a right to certain possessions, right? So it's presupposed in two of the Ten Commandments. And that's sort of the biblical point. What's funny about private property is that we now know what it actually does, because we can compare countries that have detailed titling and private property laws and those that don't. It's a wonderful book in 1999 called The Mystery of Capital by Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto, in which he sent out research teams to different countries around South America and the Caribbean to try to figure out, okay, why is so much of South America so poor, but North America, that is the United States and Canada, why are they so well off? And in fact, if anything, South America is far more resource rich than North America. And he went around, and so he had them go out and do studies, and the team that he sent to Haiti is the one that I remember. So he sent the team to Haiti, and they needed to find out what it would take to lease land from the government. Because it turns out in Haiti, a lot of the land is implicitly owned by the government. And so here's what they discovered, that they had to jump through 65 bureaucratic hoops just to lease land from the government. They wanted to buy the land, it was another 111 hoops. They estimated it would take the average Haitian working full-time 19 years to ever buy property from the government. So it's virtually, you won't be surprised to learn that in rural Haiti, about 97% of land that people live on is not actually owned by them. When you live on land that you don't own, that changes your perspective. But you're not going to plant trees, that mango trees that take 10 years to come to fruition. You're going to have a short time horizons, right? You're going to never, you're always wonder every day, are they going to run me off this land? And so whether you own property or not, De Soto realized, makes all the difference in the world in whether a culture is able to create wealth or not. The picture you see on the left is a picture outside of Buenos Aires, Argentina, a wealthy, gleaming city center with a banking center, and then these shanty towns around the edges of the city. And almost every Latin American city is like this, in which people are living in these, you know, kind of ramshackle huts where they share walls, usually don't have running water, live in, say, 300 or 400 square feet. On the right are houseboats in Portage Bay, Seattle, which is about 3/4 of a mile from the house that I lived in Seattle. Those go for between $800,000 and $1.5 million apiece. And they're, again, 500, 700 square feet, maybe 1,000 square feet. Now, what's the difference? Look how different they are, right? Is this because Seattleites are just really neat and clean? No, absolutely not. That is not what's happening. What's happening is that in Seattle, there's very detailed private property laws, right? Every square inch and every piece of property is owned by someone, and if you own it, that tells the police what they have to do, the city what they have to do, your neighbors what they have to do. You have an asset and a document that can be compared to other assets on a global market. You can use it as collateral on a loan. You've transformed a physical object into property, into this kind of symbolic object. The land on the left isn't owned by anyone, and that's exactly what it looks like. That's what private property does. So the sort of tough nut to crack in development economics is how to help countries that don't have property laws like we have in the United States actually develop them. And the reality is that it is funny, and I've got a lot of great quotes from popes, including Pope Pius XI, who said, socialism is a contradictory idea. No one can be at the same time, in his case, he says, a good Catholic and a true socialist. And the reason he says that is because socialists deny the dignity of the individual. The individual is subsumed by the state. They deny the sovereignty of the family, right? Family life doesn't have its own integrity. They deny the freedom of religious bodies. All those things are things that exist outside the state, right? They have their own rules, they have their own logic. You can only have those things in their integrity if you have a limited government. Socialism, however, it entails an all-consuming state. So it's ultimately not at all compatible with the Christian worldview or anything we would actually want as Christians. So for socialism, I'd say in summary, it's one of my favorite pictures in the world of a couple of years ago. This is the socialist president of I think it's Uruguay, Evo Morales. Pope Francis visited there, and Morales gives Pope Francis, this is a hammer and sickle and a crucifix combined. And so look at the Pope's face. I love this expression. It's like, because he's in this situation where it's like, okay, what am I going to do here? Oh, no. And so then he takes it. But the long and the short of it is socialism is both wrong and anti-Christian. Thank you very much.